Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Good to have you with us today. On today's show, we talk about the future of our state. How can we all create a successful, vibrant, and more economically viable Michigan? And what do auto sales from 2012 tell us about the year to come? But first, we turn to the nation's capital, where it's clear that the short-term compromise that Congress passed Tuesday night kept the nation from falling over that, if you'll excuse us, the fiscal cliff. But all signs point to a giant fight in the months ahead over spending, borrowing, and resolving the budget crisis. So just how will this continuing debate over the nation's economy affect us here in Michigan? To answer that question, we welcome back two of our favorites, Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes and Michigan Radio's political analyst Jack Lessenberry. Happy New Year to you both.
Happy New Year to you.
And to you.
Dan, I'll start with you. We've had a couple days now to digest this last-minute package, and I'm kind of wondering your thoughts. What do you think were the hits and the big misses?
Well, several things come to mind. One is you had the Michigan Republicans in the delegation were clearly split on this 5-3 on the vote, and they didn't. A lot of them didn't. The conservatives really didn't like it. Second thing that strikes me is the Bush tax cuts the Democrats have spent the last 10 plus years railing against were essentially made permanent for 98% of the taxpayers, which I think the Republicans take as a very small victory in this whole thing. Although they'll tout it as a bigger victory. We looked at it from another way, though. I think you could make the argument that the House Republicans lost both on taxes and on spending, meaning their pledge to not raise taxes on anybody was blown out of the water, and they agreed to do that because that was the cost of getting a package done, and there is very little to no cuts in spending, at least so far. I think they think they're going to defer that until the big debt ceiling battle going forward. The other thing that hits me, too, is that about 77% of people who work are going to be paying higher taxes. Now, that's not necessarily an income taxes, but they are federal taxes and taxes to the government.
And you're talking about the payroll taxes.
I'm talking about payroll taxes. I'm talking about, whether it could be capital gains, it could be dividends, it could be estates. I mean, you know, those issues aren't just for people that make more than $250,000 a year necessarily. So it depends on what your circumstances are. But the fact of the matter is that that's what's going to happen. And the effect on the economy is not going to be nothing. And, one person that I quoted in a column today said it could be as much as a 2% hit in GDP. That would take the economy close to almost stall speed. And I think that's something we're going to have to be mindful of, as our leading industry is, of course, a bellwether for the economic health of the nation.
And the view from Jack Lessenberry?
Well, a couple things strike me. One is that, first of all, Republicans lost the election. They have more seats in the House still because of gerrymandering. Actually, more votes were cast for Democratic House candidates. The president won by 5 million votes, and Democrats won 77% of the Senate seat. So there should be some recognition of the fact that elections have consequences. The other thing that sort of amuses me in a morbid way is that everybody, left-wing, right-wing, seems to object to paying for things they get. And one of the rules is sort of a conservative principle is that there isn't any such thing as a free lunch. And most of the tax increases that Dan's been talking about is restoring the Social Security payroll tax to what it used to be. Now, even at that level, most of us, if we live long enough, are going to get more out of Social Security, if it keeps going, than we put in. You have to pay for things, and the Republicans are mainly squalling because now those poor people who make $450,000 more or more a year are going to have to pay slightly more income tax, which I don't have any trouble sleeping at night with that.
Well, Jack's absolutely right on one very central point here, and that is paying for what you're getting. And the American voter has been conditioned by, you know, at least 25 years of politicians telling them they can get something for nothing. And the fact of the matter is that all of us talking today are paying into Social Security, and we're not paying for ourselves, we're paying for current recipients. And the money that is held by the Treasury, or the so-called IOUs, there's not a pot of money there. That's money that the Treasury has to go out and borrow. We are kicking the can down the road, to use another cliche, continually in these negotiations, and not telling people the truth. And one of the things, Jack's also right, that elections do have consequences. And one of the things I hear repeatedly is that voters love their programs. They want their Medicare. They want their Medicaid. They want their Social Security. Well, you know what? I want a Porsche 911, but I can't afford it. And the reality is that what people are saying they want, they want, they want, in the current environment that we're living in and the tax environment is not sustainable.
We talked a lot yesterday on Stateside about what this fiscal cliff compromise deal means for individuals, the average Michigan taxpayer. I want to focus with both of you, especially you, Dan, because you cover extensively Michigan businesses. Mm-hmm. What have you heard? What's their reaction to this deal?
Well, I think people are kind of trying to figure it all out at this point because mm-hmm. they're also trying to discern what Obamacare might mean for them. I did note something very interesting that a colleague of mine wrote in our paper this morning. On the people above 400,000, where the rate goes to 39.6, a lot of those, there's 28,000 Michigan businesses that could be hit by that tax increase. And there's something like on the order of 81,000 Michiganders who are working for those companies. Now, does that mean they didn't see that coming? I mean, they knew this was coming. I think for some period of time, we knew it was going to be the upper brackets were going to get hit. We just didn't know how hard. There's going to be an impact on business. There's no question that 2013 is going to be a lot more expensive to run a business than it was in 2012 when you take the tax increases on small business and then add on Obamacare taxes and other things. It's going to be a more expensive proposition. Now, the question is, how do they respond to that? Do they hire? Do they keep the workforce as they have it? I mean, I think those are things we're going to see spool out in the first half of this year, probably. You know, we're going to have this battle in the end of February and early March on the debt ceiling, and I think that's going to be the next step. But what it does, I think, is freeze people in place a little bit. They know a little bit about what their burdens are going to be for the 2013 tax year, but they really don't know all of it at this point.
I want to talk about the debt ceiling battle because we know it's coming a couple of months down the road, and focusing on Michigan and what you both think it'll mean for the state budget, because it certainly appears state officials are kind of cautious watching these continuing negotiations because they could include proposed cuts to state-administered programs like, you know, food stamps and Medicaid. And what's another fight over the debt ceiling going to mean for Michigan?
I think it's that question of state-administered programs, but it's the broader question about what it means to the economy and what it does to markets. I think we're looking at the president has said repeatedly, I'm not going to negotiate over the debt ceiling, and I think we all know that's just not true. He is going to have to negotiate over the debt ceiling, and it's going to be a very fraught period of time. I'm concerned about it because I don't think we have any idea how this thing's going to play out. And the president is not really good at negotiating here. He had to send Joe Biden out. This is something that's not talked about a lot because he stopped negotiating. He was not involved in the negotiations,
Yeah. And
the vice president was. That was a point of great frustration for Republicans. So my concern going into this thing is there's no question the White House understands the stakes here. You don't want to be the president of the United States and precipitate a default. There's no question about it, irrespective of your party. That said, he's going to have to get a deal. And what it means for Michigan? Well, you mentioned it, state-administered programs. What does it mean for auto sales? What does it mean for consumer confidence? There's all sorts of questions out there. The good news for autos is that they're moving ahead quickly, having a very best year since 2007, according to the numbers out today, and should be better next year because the fleet is so old. It's almost 11 years old, which is the oldest in anybody's memory.
Jack, what do you think? Is there any sense that Barack Obama, knowing that this is his second term, wants to leave a solid legacy, so might be open, even whether it's through Biden or maybe Leon Panetta, who has a lot of prestige within the House for his years there, sending them out to bargain? Do you see any room for movement, or are you afraid that it's more of the same old, same old?
Well, I agree with Dan, except that I think it makes perfect sense to send Biden. Biden was in the Senate when the president was 11 years old, and you use people who have strengths. That's absolutely true.
It's true.
Well, no, point taken.
So you use people with this expertise.
Sure.
But what I'm more concerned about is they will cobble together something, and if Republicans will only threaten to close down the government if they think the Democrats are going to be blamed. But the problem is that we need to get into a cycle where we don't keep doing this every 3 months. We need to have some kind of a grand bargain and a long-term strategy, and I don't see any sign of that.
I think it just underscores the short-term tactical nature of politics in Washington and the short attention span that politicians and a lot of media people and voters have. And it's not healthy. Jack's absolutely right. And it's also, I would argue, a failure of leadership, both from the White House and from Congress.
Well, I think I disagree a little bit on that. The president did get his health care plan passed. He was the first president ever to do that. He did get this deal done by using people who had more expertise at it than he does. And the Republicans in Washington remind me a bit of the Democrats in Lansing right now, in that both sides don't really have an alternative program. They're just sort of squalling no. I have not seen any really sensible, coherent Republican alternative to dealing with the debt crisis, and it would be nice if there was one.
Well, now, wait a minute, Jack. They have put forth some of these proposals, and they get shouted down. One of the things they talked about was indexing. I think it was Medicare or Social Security. I think it was Social Security in this debate, and they pressed the point, and the Republicans and the Democrats squawked and said, no way, and the Republicans said, okay, and that was it. I mean, it's just one example. The House Republicans passed budgets the last couple of years. The Senate hasn't passed a budget in, what, 3 or 4 years.
But what we need is some grown-ups. We need some grown-ups on both sides and to sit down and not worrying about undercutting each other and try to figure out, is sort of during the Cold War, people talked about the fact that politics stopped at the water's edge. You had bipartisan foreign policy. We need to have a bipartisan agreement that taking the country over any kind of a cliff is not a good idea. And if we can get some agreement on that, I think both parties can claim that they've done something.
Look, it's all about relations. Politics is all about relationships, and relationships depend on trust. And if you don't have that kind of trust, you can't get stuff done.
And we'll have to leave it there. But we always appreciate your insights, Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes and Michigan Radio's political analyst Jack Lessendary. Thanks for talking with us today.
We trust you, Cynthia.
All right. Thank you. And speaking of Congress, coming up next, we talk to an outgoing Michigan congressman, David Curson. He took over Representative Thaddeus McCotter's seat in a special election last fall. We'll ask him what it's really like in Congress. And gay at-risk kids are finding safety in the world of Vogue dancing. Yes, as in Madonna's Strike a Pose. We'll find out more in 15 minutes. This is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The 113th Congress convened for the first time today at noon. That got us thinking about one of the more intriguing stories in Michigan congressional politics, the very short 7-week term of Representative David Curson. Curson is a Democrat and a UAW activist. He was chosen in a special election to fill Republican Thaddeus McCotter's congressional seat for the final weeks of the 112th Congress. That's after McCotter resigned amidst that big scandal. You remember that one over the aides who forged signatures on his reelection petitions. Congressman Curson took office November 6th, and his term ended today. The seat now belongs to Republican Kerry Benevolio. David Curson joins us from Washington. So you have had the chance now to be part of the workings of Congress. And to those of us watching from the outside, it seems that the partisan divisions are so strong and so bitter, one side won't even talk to the other. So tell us, what is it really like away from the cameras and the microphones? Is there any conversation or any sense of cooperation across party lines?
Well, that's a complicated question. There is a lot of conversation between individuals from each party. I had conversation with many of the Republicans, very good and very deep conversations, but they can't be committal, and actually we can't be committal no matter what side you're on, because on these big issues, it works up through the party, and then decisions are made at the top, and then they funnel back down, and like any other institution, you've got your say, and you've got your vote. But the powers to be will try to persuade different settlements on different issues, which is a good way to do it. I mean, everybody gets their say in our caucus meetings. Everybody gets up and they speak their say, and I'm sure the Republicans do something very similar. But unfortunately, in ours, in our side, we go to a vote. The leadership takes its best position, and then everybody's free to do whatever they're going to do, at least in my short experience. I can't speak for all the time. But just this, what I've experienced, what I've watched happen, and on the other side of the house, is a very small, very loud group of people that aren't even in the mainstream of their own side, is creating all this division. And rather than bring it out and take it to a vote and let everybody expose themselves for who they are and what they represent, they're trying to keep the Republican Party somewhat together on the Sunday talk shows, when actually they're very fragmented. And I can say that with confidence, just at the vote on the disaster relief for Sandy.
Yes.
Those people weren't Republicans or Democrats out there with no power and no house and sleeping in their pickup trucks. Those people are American citizens, and Congress has always, 100% of the time, came to lend a hand to in any national disaster. But that same, I'm told, that very same small, loud group said that after voting for this bill, after passing this bill, they weren't going to do any more big spending. So rather than taking it to the floor, because there's no question that most of the Republicans would have supported a relief bill, and showing that marked division in the party, the leadership decided, even under all this criticism, to put the vote off until the 113th Congress, hoping they can get a better mix.
Now, House Speaker Boehner says there'll be a vote tomorrow morning for $9 billion at least to get it started, and then more to come. But that actually led to an interesting comment I saw from New Jersey Governor Chris Christie reacting to that Sandy relief bill. And here's his quote: "They're so consumed by their own palace intrigues that they forget we sent them there." What's your reaction to that?
I think without a doubt, and I've been saying this all along, I don't know of a single representative in the House of Representatives that has an entire district full of billionaires. I can't believe that people would hold hostage 20 million kids for their hot lunch program, or 2 million seniors for their Meals on Wheels, hold them hostage over the richest 2% of wealthiest Americans. It was just to me unimaginable. And they did that. And there was many of them that would have taken us right over the cliff. If you look at the numbers, how many voted to go over the cliff, it's staggering. And 98% of America is feeling the benefit from what happened. Now, is there work to do? Oh, yeah, there's still a lot of work to do, and we do have to cut the deficit, and we can do that, and we can do it bipartisanly. But this small, loud group has no compromise whatsoever. I just think that it could be handled so much better. But, again, even though I've been there 7 weeks, I'm still an outsider. And these people, I mean, so many of them, on both sides, dedicate their life to do the right thing.
So that kind of, dare I say, popular image of a disconnected legislator who's just, you know, locked in that Washington bubble, I'm hearing, yeah, it's true, but no, it's not, because there are passionate people who do care very much, is what you're saying.
Very, very, very much. On both sides. Again, there's nothing wrong with an ideology difference, because that's how you strike a balance. You got to have the conservative side and the liberal side, and once they work through a problem and everybody gets a little piece of something, you're somewhere in the middle where you can satisfy everyone. But if you get somebody extreme on either side, and you get them with enough power, enough money behind them, then that destroys the system and it doesn't work anymore.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with outgoing Congressman David Curzon, who took office November 6th after filling Thaddeus McCotter's 11th congressional seat after the Republican resigned over the summer. And after your small experience as being part of Congress, why do you think, Congressman, that the approval rating is so low for Congress amongst the American public?
Well, it's not only amongst the American public, because the congressmen themselves were calling them the 112th Congress, the do-nothing Congress. The famous do-nothing Congress, I believe it was in 1980, one of the presidents dubbed the Congress the do-nothing Congress. They passed three times more legislation than this Congress, because this Congress has came to a complete halt because the other side, we say the other side, and I'm sure they'll say us, won't compromise on anything. It's their way or no way. And with the rules in the House, if it doesn't get on the House floor, It doesn't matter if you got a majority in the Senate, you can't get anything passed. So that's where it's been. This has been a do-nothing Congress, the worst Congress in history as far as getting any work done.
What's next for you now? Do you want to run for something else?
You know, I love the work because this is so much what I've done my whole life as a UAW rep. That's what you do. You take care of people's problems. But I'm not sure I got the stomach for all the political part of it, with your hand out all the time asking for money. Not that that's wrong, because to compete, you got to have a campaign fund. But it's just not my nature to be able to do that. So I'll be involved somehow, but I doubt very much that I'll run for office again.
Congressman David Curzon, Happy New Year to you, and thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Over the past few weeks, we've been taking a closer look at homelessness in Metro Detroit. Today, we visit a center that serves homeless and at-risk young people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and questioning. The Ruth Ellis Center. It's located on a side street in a post-industrial era area of Highland Park. It's down the road from the Detroit plant where Henry Ford invented the Model T. The center provides warm meals, counseling, new clothes, support groups, health services, and the most popular and well-used service, a washer and dryer. But the center also offers something especially meaningful to these young people. It helps get them in the center's front door, and that's dancing, specifically voguing. Michigan Radio's Kyle Norris looks at why this art form means so much to this group.
Loud beats are blasting through the speakers at the Ruth Ellis Center. It feels like a dance club, but it's the middle of the day. And this is actually a drop-in center for LGBTQ homeless and at-risk youth. About 20 to 30 young people flip, dip, and catwalk in a dance style that's known as Vogue. For a quick reference, think of Madonna's Vogue video from 1990.
Strike the pose.
Here's 21-year-old dancer Donnie Dawson. He's giving us a baby simple version of a basic Vogue dance move. He says, pretend you're holding a basketball and mime with your hands the circular shape of the ball.
And if you feel like you're Jordan and you want to do some extra with the ball, you can start with one hand and you could make a ball with one hand. It's all about your wrist and your imagination. You just have to make sure.
And the dancers here are wild with imagination. They put their personal stamp on a dance form that is acrobatic, sexual, and often very feminine in its movements. They are also fashion forward. One young man wears hot pink tights, red short shorts, pink socks, and a tie-dye t-shirt. While the dancer in the shades, in the middle of the day, inside, is Matthew Dawson. He says voguing is a powerful and personal way for him to express himself.
One of the emotions that I say I put into my Vogue would maybe be anger. I feel like I put it into Vogue so I won't have to put it into other things that are not very constructive. Do you understand what I mean by that? Some sadness. I wouldn't say sadness as in I'm sad all the time, but some emotions that you don't want to express in front of everybody.
He says as an LGBT young person, if he danced like this in the outside world or on the streets, he would not be safe. And Vogue dancers find safety in their dance community. Vogue was created by gay folks in New York City in the 60s and 70s, mostly by poor and working class Black and Latino men. They would compete in the ballroom scene for money and fame and respect in events called balls. And in the scene, people form houses. It's kind of like a team. And a house has an entire roster that includes a mother and a father and children and so on. Here's an excerpt from a documentary about the history of Vogue called Paris is Burning. This dancer is giving the definition of a house.
They're families. You can say that. They're families for a lot of children who don't have families. But this is a new meaning of family.
And it's not uncommon for some of the young people who come to the Ruth Ellis Center to have been kicked out or disowned by their birth families. In fact, 40% of homeless youth in this country identify as gay. So the houses these young people form in the dance world become a kind of family and a form of emotional and physical protection, as dancer Donnie Dawson explains.
When that relationship is really close and really tight, it turns into a family to where it extends far beyond any ballroom. It's all down to if I'm stranded somewhere and I need some help, I can call you and you'll be there.
Dawson is part of a house that's become a family. His gay mother is LaKyra Dawson. She's a transgender woman, so born male but now identifies and presents as a woman. And since her last name is Dawson, her gay family members have taken that last name as their own. Donnie and LaKyra met several years ago at a ball, and they had an instant connection. In fact, LaKyra turned to Donnie and she said,
I kind of just was like, you know, you're my son.
They dance together and hang out, and they spend holidays together. And LaKyra has given Donnie lots of life guidance. She's a big advocate for staying in school and getting a job, in part because she dropped out of high school. She ran away from home at age 13 and then spent 10 years on and off the streets.
That's a lot of things to know and see and do and experience. So I just take from that. Like you said, my mistakes, I use that as, you know, the rule book. Like, don't do this, stay away from that.
She says no one looked out for her when she was younger, so now she wants to steer her kids in the right direction and help them avoid things like prostitution, drug use, or contracting HIV. So LaKyra has pushed Donnie to pursue his education, which he's now doing at Wayne County Community College, where he's studying social work. Donnie Dawson says in the world of Vogue dancing, he's found the closest, most dependable people he knows. And that's why, to him, LaKyra is his mother.
Everything that I learned from her is broader and bigger than just me being gay. So that's why I don't go around and be like, gay mom, I call her mama, because the knowledge that I get from her is way far beyond gay life.
Donnie's not only found family in the world of Vogue, but he's also found a way to relieve his stress. He says he feels like a target as a gay man walking down the street, and he is always on guard for confrontation. But through dance, Donnie says he can unwind. And as he says, let the creativity flow out of his veins. For Stateside, I'm Kyle Norris. Strike the pose.
And if you'd like to see what these young Vogue dancers look like, you can watch a video. Just go to our website at michiganradio.org. And now to another perspective from someone who's been spending time at the Ruth Ellis Center. She is a professional dancer. She got in touch with the center because she wanted to help the LGBTQ kids who go there. She teaches them ballet. But the youth have also been teaching her about the world of voguing. Kyle Norris has this audio postcard.
Teenagers have a hard time with their bodies changing. And then sometimes if your body's not changing the way you see your body changing, the way society sees your body changing are different from each other, then you can end up having this relationship with your body that's like a fight. And I thought it'd be nice to do dancing because it's an experience where you just can enjoy moving. My name's Adeshola Akinle, and I'm a dancer and choreographer. So I had that sort of idea, and then I contacted the centre, and then we came and talked about what I've done in the past and asked them what could you do with me if I'm as a kind of resource. And they said they'd like to learn ballet, and I think it's the sort of formalization, like having a formal kind of language to move in. Everyone works really, really hard in the class and very enthusiastic, and people in the class really seem to love moving, and I love moving too, so it's a really happy moment to share things that you love together. They've been teaching me a few moves and I know a little bit about it. It's very much about a kind of virtuosity of movement, and ballet is too. And when they were showing me one step and I was trying to learn it, they were saying, it's your catwalk. Like, you make the catwalk who you are. Just be who you are. And when I was trying to be me, they were like, well done. That's a really big lesson. That's a really important thing to know about yourself, and that getting back to teenagers and young people and what people expect you to be, to kind of understand that and then embody it every time you dance is a very knowledgeable thing to do.
And next week on Stateside, Kyle Norris will introduce us to an interior designer who works her magic to transform homeless shelters. That's the last story in our series, Looking at Homelessness in Metro Detroit. We always want to hear from you. We'd love to get your thoughts. Find us online. Go to michiganradio.org and look for the link that says Stateside. You can go to Facebook and search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and that's C-A-N-T-Y. And on Twitter, at Stateside Radio. Still to come on Stateside, a look ahead at auto sales with Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton. And we'll explore some new ideas on how Michigan can prosper. You're listening to Michigan Radio, and this is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Forget the Kentucky Derby or the Preakness or the Belmont Stakes. If you live in Michigan, chances are pretty good you have a stake in auto sales and auto companies. And that's the horse race we're looking at today. Car sales numbers for 2012 are in. Our Tracy Samilton joins us now. So, Tracy, car sales in the U.S. for 2012. Who are the rankings? Who did best and who did worst?
Well, let's break it down. We'll have the leaders and the come-from-behinds and then the wannabes.
All right.
So the leaders, GM. Number one, okay. Sold 2.6 million cars. Now, that's a loss of market share for GM. So even though they're number one, you know, the people behind them, Ford and Toyota, they're pretty close. Ford sold 2.17 million cars and Toyota sold 2.08 million cars. So you can see there's really not that much of a difference between these three leaders in the race. They're very close.
And Toyota really came back after the tsunami.
It really did. It really came back very strongly, very aggressively.
So who's come from behind companies?
Well, you've got, I'd say, Chrysler and Honda. You know, you look at Chrysler, they sold 1.65 million cars. That's up 21% from the year before. Just a couple of years ago, that company was sixth largest in the U.S. It's now fourth. It has really moved up.
From death's doorstep.
Yeah, very
really?
Close.
Yeah.
And then Honda sold 1.4 million, up 24%, really strongly recovering from the tsunami, just like Toyota.
Now, the wannabes?
Well, we've got Nissan, we've got Volkswagen, Hyundai, Kia, Mazda. I'd look at Volkswagen here, their increase was 30% from the year before. They are really, really coming strongly from the back of the pack here.
And at the very end,
one of the horses didn't make it. Suzuki has decided it will no longer sell cars in the U.S., and so that horse is pretty much out of the race.
Yeah, I think that's just going to be a little whimper because they really didn't sell much to be missed here,
did they?
They
didn't.
So when you add up everybody's sales, what do you get, Tracy?
You get 14.5 million approximately. We don't have all the numbers in yet, but that's about it. And that is a really healthy increase from last year, or rather the year before, 12.8 million. And we expect 2013 to be even better.
Well, we know the U.S. is not the whole picture. How about that other horse race, the global horse race?
Okay. It's a little different there. You know, GM may have lost market share in the U.S., but it's still going really strong in this global race. And we'll probably see Toyota, number one, squeaking out a win, and then GM, and then Volkswagen. And then you've got a different kind of wannabe. Ford Motor Company, I think you could argue, is a wannabe because they're trying to increase their sales in China, and they're having a bit of trouble catching up there. And then back of the race, you've got Chrysler and Fiat, and they're really far behind. They are not even competing in some regions of the world at this point. So they have a lot of ground to gain.
So, Tracy, we've looked at sales, but we also need to look at profits because there's really an important difference there.
That's right. You can sell a lot of cars, but at not much profit. And GM did that for a number of years in the bad old days, and they got in trouble. You need to have high volume and you need to have high profits. That means you can afford to reinvest in your cars and continue to be a strong competitor.
And that's good news for the U.S. economy.
This is good news for the U.S. economy. It's good news for the global economy as well. We've got all these companies really doing the right thing.
Okay, thanks for that horse race result, Tracy.
I'm happy to provide it.
Tracy Sambleton covers the auto industry for Michigan Radio. Talk to just about anyone who's been living here in Michigan over the past few years, and you won't get much of an argument if you stated Michigan needs an overhaul. Even as economic signs point to recovery from the depths of the Great Recession, it's really not time to celebrate. When compared to the most successful thriving states in the Union, Michigan's nowhere in that league. But we could be. That's what Lou Glaser believes. For some two decades, Lou and his think tank, Michigan Future, have been churning out ideas for helping Michigan overhaul itself and climb back to prosperity. Lou Glaser, you say we need to align Michigan culture with the flat world realities. Just what do you mean by that?
You know, flat world is this term that Tom Friedman, the New York Times columnist, coined a while ago to basically communicate the notion that because of globalization and technology, that increasingly work can be done any place by anybody. So we've really, since we got started in 1991, we've believed that those two forces, globalization and technology, are mega forces that are simply more powerful than politics or policy. You know, I think people have this notion, if we only had the right government in Lansing or Washington, we could stop or slow down sort of these changes. You can't.
And you see the parties really play into that.
Oh, exactly. Well, and I think in part it's because voters basically want their old job back, and so politicians are not comfortable telling voters they can't do that. But the reality is they can't. A lot of the stuff that's gone away has gone away because machines are now doing the work that people used to do. I mean, you look at sort of borders, you know, and they're gone because you can buy books in completely different ways. That's not politics that did that. It's technology.
It's the pressures.
You know, we've always believed, and I think Michigan history indicates, that the places that do best are those that are aligning with the trends rather than trying to resist the trends. So if you look at Michigan's history, as we tell folks, this has been sort of such a terrible decade for us in Michigan that I think we tend to lose sight that we actually had a 100-year run. We were one of the most prosperous places on the planet for most of the 20th century. And the reason was is that we were Silicon Valley 100 years ago. We invented the next American economy. So that's what we have to do again. As long as we're trying to hang on to the economy of the past, we're going to get poorer compared to the country.
So I think I hear you say Michigan has to find the 21st century equivalent of that Model T plant that changed things in the 20th century.
Right, except it won't be a plant.
No. Exactly. But it has to be looking.
Exactly. You have to be inventing what's next. You know, and I think one of the reasons we've been having trouble making the transition is that sort of 20th century economy was so good to us. I mean, we had it better than anybody else.
Yeah.
It's very hard to let go of A, stuff that you invent, and B, stuff that was terrific. And so we're having probably more than most states problems making that transition. And the interesting thing is every time that we get a bounce in the auto economy, which is really what's happening in Michigan now, our instinct is to think that the old economy can come back.
Sales are up. Oh, they're hiring at the plants.
They're hiring at the plants, exactly.
Yes. So we really need to collectively as a state, both citizens and leaders, get with a new program. And actually, you call for a new agenda for a new Michigan. Talk about the cornerstone that you see of this new agenda.
The thing that we've been having most trouble with is not the new agenda. It's the understanding that you need a new Michigan, which then leads to the new agenda. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the places across the country that are doing the best, if you look at the states that are doing the best, they have four common characteristics. The first is that they are over-concentrated compared to the country in both their employment but also their wages that come from the knowledge-based part of the economy. That's the growing part of the economy. And by knowledge-based, you know, Don Grimes here at the University of Michigan and I who do this research have basically defined it as sort of industries where a high proportion of the workers have a four-year degree or more.
What would some of those states be? Give us a for instance. Who's
right.
doing
so
the best?
So the states that are sort of the top 10 states are Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Minnesota, New Hampshire, Illinois, Delaware, and Colorado. So Michigan's fundamental problem is that we are 36th in college attainment. Third, which is very interesting, which I think we didn't know and a lot of the futurists didn't predict, is that both college-educated adults and knowledge-based employers are concentrating in big metros anchored by vibrant central cities.
And we have a little problem there in Michigan.
Exactly. So that's the common characteristic of these lists is that it's, you know, it's Boston, Washington, New York, Denver, Minneapolis,
Chicago,
Chicago,
yeah.
San Jose.
Yeah.
So those are the four characteristics. So the new agenda that we developed is based on how do you create a place with those four characteristics.
We're talking with Lou Glaser about his new agenda for a new Michigan. He is with Michigan Future. Lou, you talk about the need to create places where talent wants to live. That's
right.
That vibrant metro area you've
exactly.
talked about. It doesn't take an expert to look around Michigan and realize, boy, are we hurting there.
Exactly.
Now, Grand Rapids seems to have at least, if you live on the southeast side of the state, you look at Grand Rapids, it seems mm-hmm. to have a pretty good buzz about it.
Right.
What are your thoughts?
It has great buzz and pretty disappointing results. You know, in the report that we do every year, we look at all the metros in the country with populations of a million or more. Mm-hmm. So in Grand Rapids' case, it's like a seven-county area that includes Grand Rapids, Muskegon, and Holland. Of the 54 big metros, they are next to last in per capita income. They're the third poorest big metro in the country, and they are in the bottom 10 in college attainment. So, you know, it's pretty interesting. We spend an awful lot of time in this state arguing about sort of this so-called, you know, Metro Detroit, Metro Grand Rapids.
The them and us.
Yeah, you know, them and us kind of stuff. And even if you add Metro Lansing into the equation, mm-hmm. all three metros basically look the same.
They Very are, troubled.
Well, in the case of Detroit and Grand Rapids, they're way too connected to the old economy and they're undereducated. And in the case of Lansing, they are way too government-dependent and undereducated. So none of them have vibrant sort of knowledge-based private sectors or large concentrations of college-educated adults.
And this, I would say to inject Flint would certainly be
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Even,
well, right. In our data, Flint is part of Metro Detroit. But
okay.
if you pull it out, it's even worse.
Yes.
The problem is that for Detroit, including Ann Arbor, Grand Rapids and Lansing. There are places around the country with similar populations and characteristics that are doing fine. Sort of smaller mid-sized metros like Flint that are not anchored by major research universities are having trouble across the country.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easier to see Detroit sort of coming out of this and Grand Rapids coming out of this and Lansing coming out of this and driving the Michigan economy. It's harder to see Flint, Saginaw, Battle Creek, Jackson. I mean, those places across the country are struggling, and it's because of this consumer preference on the part of college-educated adults for big metros. I mean, it's once again, it's not government. It's what people want.
It's a driving force, like you say. It has nothing to do with politics, parties, or government.
Yes, exactly.
What's the takeaway for citizens and policymakers in Michigan? What will we do to create these places where talent wants to live?
You know, our agenda has sort of five items on it. We surprised ourselves. The folks that are involved with Michigan Future all tend to be pretty policy-driven, and yet we ended up concluding that sort of culture, attitudes and beliefs, not arts and culture, that culture trumps policy, that sort of the places that are doing the best have as their core characteristic a community DNA that highly values learning, entrepreneurship, and that's entrepreneurship as the opposite of sort of being entitled to sort of a job kind of thing and not just starting businesses, and being welcoming to all.
Wow.
Those are three things that Michigan historically has struggled with. So figuring out how we build communities that, once again, have a set of attitudes and beliefs that are consistent with a much more globalized knowledge-based economy probably is the most important. In terms of policy, we've basically argued that there are three key policies, which are very different than the agenda offered really by either party. So our policy agenda is about preparing talent, sort of your teaching and learning system,
okay.
and then retaining and attracting talent. So the three items that we've made a priority, one is reversing this, what we consider to be really stupid, decade-long slashing of state support for higher education. I mean, Michigan's got a pretty interesting story that actually makes no sense. In the 20th century, when higher education was not all that important to the economy, we arguably built the best higher education system on the planet. In the 21st century, where it is predictive of economic success, we've been systematically disinvesting in it. We've reduced state spending. This is not corrected for inflation. This is in just nominal dollars by a third, more than $1 billion. It makes no sense. So we've got to reinvest in higher ed.
Basically undercutting exactly what it would take to help build a new Michigan.
Exactly.
Okay.
I mean, they're
so that's
probably
the first.
Right. And they're probably the most important institutions to rebuilding a new Michigan. And at the core are the research universities. And Michigan is one of the few places that have three leading research universities. Mm-hmm. And we've been cutting our support for them as well. So that makes no sense. Second is, if we want to stay on the teaching and learning side of things, we really do need to reinvent sort of, you know, what Governor Snyder is calling P20 education, or your K-12 system, which is still basically a line for the old economy.
Mm-hmm.
And then third is, folks are now starting to take seriously this notion that where mobile talent moves is a major determinant in whether or not you're going to be prosperous or not.
Okay.
You know, it is this notion that sort of where talented people go, companies have to follow them rather than the other way around, because talent's now the asset that's the most valuable and has the highest shortages. So, you know, we keep using this story. Google just paid $1.9 billion for one office building in Manhattan. You know, they probably could have bought all the real estate in Metro Detroit for $1.9 billion. The reason you buy one office building in Manhattan is you can't find the talent anyplace else.
Mm.
So anyways, because people are now taking it seriously, they're starting to talk to mobile talent about why they decide where they're going to go. And at least for recent college graduates, in all of the polling, a majority, in one poll as many as two-thirds, say that they decide where they want to live first and then look for a job.
Mm.
Then you look where they move, and they're moving to these vibrant central cities. In our case, it's sort of the Chicago. So quality of place matters enormously. Higher ed is number one. Reinventing K-12 is two. Sort of creating places where mobile talent wants to live, particularly vibrant central cities, is third on our list. On our policy list, and then we conclude the five with the need for new leadership. I mean, we need both private sector leadership and public sector leadership in Michigan to actually be honest with people about the need to make this transition. So that's the five-part agenda.
Luca Lazier, when you're sitting alone and just kind of thinking of Michigan and what your hopes are, where do you honestly in your gut think Michigan will be in 10 or 20 years?
This trend has been going on now for at least 20, maybe 30 years in Michigan, which is that we've been getting poorer compared to the country. So in 2000, sort of at the end of this 100-year run, we were 18th in per capita income. We were still one of the top 20 states in the country. Today, we are 39th in 2010, which is the last data that's available. So
it's quite a slide.
It's the farthest, fastest ever. No one's ever fallen that fast. So the trends are is that we are increasingly becoming one of the places around the country that is anchored in the old economy, and is if those trends continue, we're going to be one of the poorest states in the country. But the optimistic side is that we can reverse it. But the way to reverse it is to build the assets that you need to participate in the growing part of the American economy, not the declining part of the American economy.
Do you think the willingness is there?
So at the moment, I'd say no. But, you know, we continue to be hopeful that we can get there.
Keep pushing that message.
Thank you.
Lou Glaser, New Agenda for a New Michigan, and he is, of course, with his think tank, Michigan Future. Thanks for talking with us today, Lou.
My pleasure.
And we'd like to hear your thoughts. What would you add to the New Agenda for a New Michigan? What do you think needs to be done to make Michigan a more successful state? You can share your ideas. Just email us through michiganradio.org or post your thoughts on our Facebook page. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon, and it was directed today by Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us, and let's talk again at 3 on Monday.